The real reason why one can't change.
Let's hear it. What am I supposed to relearn about Adler?
When you look at your speech and conduct and at other people's speech and conduct, think about the goals that are hidden in them. This is a basic way of thinking in Adlerian psychology.
I know, it's teleology, right?
Would you give a simple explanation of it?
I will try. Regardless of what may have occurred in the past, nothing is determined by it. It does not matter if there are past traumas either, because human beings are not driven by past causes, but live according to present goals. Suppose, for example, a person says, "My home environment was bad, and that's why I have a dark personality." This is a life lie. The truth is that the person has the goal of, "I don't want to get hurt by getting involved with other people." And in order to realize that goal, they choose a dark personality that doesn't get involved with anyone. Then, as an excuse for having chosen such a personality themselves, they bring up their past home environment. It's something like that, right?
Yes. Please continue.
In other words, we are not creatures who are determined by past events. Rather, we determine our own lives according to the meaning we give to those events.
That's right.
And then you said something like this. No matter what has occurred in your life until now, it has no bearing at all on how you live your life from now on, and that you, living here and now, are the one who decides your own life. So, did I get anything wrong?
Thank you. No, you did not get anything wrong. We humans are not so fragile as to simply be at the mercy of past traumas. Adler's ideas are based on a strong belief in human dignity and the potential that human beings can determine themselves at any time.
Yes, I know that. It's just that I cannot get past the strength of the causes. It's hard to speak of everything as just being goals. Because, for example, even if I had the goal of not wanting to be involved with other people, there would have to be causes somewhere that gave rise to those goals. To me, that teleology is not an almighty truth, even if it is a revolutionary viewpoint.
That is fine. Something might change through this dialogue here tonight, and something might not. That is for you to decide, and I will not force you. Now, please, hear this as one way of thinking. We are beings who are capable of determining ourselves at any time. We can choose new selves. Yet it is not so easy to change oneself. One might have a strong wish to change, but be unable to. Why is this? Can you tell me your opinion?
Because one doesn't really want to change?
That about sums it up. And this is also connected to the question, what is change? If we go out on a limb and take it to an extreme, carrying out change is death itself.
Death itself?
Suppose, for example, that you are in distress over your life right now. Let's say that you are wishing you could change yourself. But changing yourself means giving up on, denying, and never again showing the face of yourself until now, as if you were sending it to its grave, in effect. Because once you have done that, you will be reborn as your new self at last. Now, regardless of how dissatisfied you may be with your current situation, can you choose death? Can you throw yourself into the bottomless darkness? This is not such an easy thing to accomplish. That is why people do not try to change, and why they want to feel okay with things as they are, no matter how tough life gets. And they end up living in search of okay-as-I-am ingredients in order to affirm their current situation. So when a person is actively trying to affirm myself now, what kind of tone do you think it will give to that person's past?
In other words...
There is only one answer. In short, it would be to sum up their past by saying, "I've been through a lot, but I'm fine with it."
In order to affirm now, one also affirms the past that was unhappy.
Yes, the people you mentioned earlier who convey their gratitude by saying, "Thank you very much for rebuking me so harshly back then," they are all actively trying to affirm myself now. As a result, their entire past turns into good memories. They are not going to recognize their authoritarian education with only those words of gratitude they conveyed to you.
Since they want to feel, "I'm fine with this," their past turns into good memories. It's intriguing. As an academic psychology, it is a very interesting line of inquiry. However, I cannot agree with your interpretations. Why, you ask? Because I am proof. I do not fit in this model at all. To this day, I am resentful of all the strict and unreasonable teachers I had in my years in middle school and high school, and right or wrong, I am not grateful to them. There is no way that my school life, which was like prison time to me, could ever turn into good memories.
That must be because you are not satisfied with myself now.
What did you say?
To put it more bluntly, in order to justify a myself now that is far from ideal, you are painting your entire past the same shade of grey. You are trying to think of it as that school's fault or because of that teacher. And then you are trying to live in possibility. If it had been the ideal school and I'd met the ideal teacher, I never would have ended up this way.
That's beyond rude. What grounds do you have to make such assumptions?
Can you really say for sure that I'm making assumptions? Because the question is not whether something happened in the past, but what meaning myself now gives to that past.
Retract that. What do you know about me?
Look, in our world, the past, in the real sense of the word, does not exist. It is just painted in an endless array of colors of now, each with its own interpretations.
In this world, the past does not exist?
That's right. The past is not something that cannot be regained. Rather, it simply and purely does not exist. Until one takes it that far, one cannot get any closer to the essence of teleology.
Ugh, this is exasperating. You make assumptions and then say things like, "the past does not exist." You're tossing out hole-filled falsehoods left and right, and then you're trying to blow smoke. I'm going to have fun dredging the muck out of all those holes and throwing it right back at you.
Your now decides the past.
It is true that this argument is difficult to accept, but if you calmly lay out all the facts, I'm sure you will agree, because there is no other path here.
Well, it seems to me that the heart of your passion for these ideas has burned a hole in your head. If you say the past doesn't exist, then how do you explain history? Maybe your beloved Socrates and Plato didn't exist? Look, that's what you're implying. So you're going to be ridiculed as unscientific.
History is a grand story that is continually manipulated by the powers that be of the time. It is always manipulated with great skill on the basis of the logic of the powerful to say, "It is I who am just." All chronologies and history books are apocrypha, compiled for the purpose of proving the legitimacy of those currently in power. In history, it is always the now that is the most correct, and whenever one authority is overthrown, a new ruler will rewrite the past again. But they will do so only for the purpose of explaining their own legitimacy. So, the past, in the most basic sense of the word, does not exist.
But,
for example, suppose an armed group of a certain country is planning a coup d'état. If they are suppressed and the attempt ends in failure, they will be defamed in the history books as traitors. On the other hand, if they succeed and the government is overthrown, their names will be remembered in history as heroes who took a stand against tyranny.
Because history is always written by the victor?
It is the same with us as individuals. Every person is a compiler of a story of me who rewrites his or her own past as desired to prove the legitimacy of me now.
No, it's different with the individual. The individual's past and memory is the domain of neuroscience. Stay out of it. An outdated philosopher like you has no business there.
With regard to memory, think of it like this. From the innumerable events that have happened in a person's past, that person chooses only those events that are compatible with their present goals, gives meaning to them, and turns them into memories. And, conversely, events that run counter to the present goals are erased.
Huh?
Okay, I'll give you an example from my counseling. Once, a man I was counseling recalled an incident from his childhood in which a dog attacked him and bit his leg. Apparently, his mother had often told him, "If you see a stray dog, stay completely still, because if you run, it will chase you." There used to be a lot of stray dogs roaming the streets, you see. So one day he came across a stray dog on the side of the road. A friend who had been walking with him ran away, but he obeyed his mother's instructions and stayed rooted to the spot. And the dog attacked him and bit his leg.
Are you saying that memory was a lie that he fabricated?
It was not a lie. It is probably true that he was bitten. However, there must have been more to the story. After several sessions of counseling, the continuation came back to him. While he was crouching down in pain after getting bitten by the dog, a man who happened to be riding by on a bicycle stopped, helped him get up, and took him straight to the hospital. In the early stages of counseling, his lifestyle, worldview, had been that the world is a perilous place and people are my enemies. To this man, the memory of having been bitten by a dog was an event signifying that this world is a place full of danger. However, once he had begun, little by little, to be able to think, "The world is a safe place and people are my comrades," episodes that supported that way of thinking started coming back to him. Was he bitten by a dog? Or was he helped by another person? The reason Adlerian psychology is considered a psychology of use is this aspect of being able to choose one's own life. The past does not decide now. It is your now that decides the past.
That bad person and poor me.
So we choose our own lives and our own pasts?
Yes, there probably isn't anyone who leads a problem-free life. Every person has sad experiences and setbacks and suffers unbearable treatment and great disappointment. Then why do some people refer to tragedies as lessons or memories, while others remain shackled to such events and regard them as inviolable traumas? This is not being shackled to the past. That past, coloured by unhappiness, is something one needs. Though it may be putting it harshly, it could be said that one is getting drunk on the cheap wine of tragedy and trying to forget the bitterness of an unfortunate now.
Enough! You've got some nerve. Cheap wine of tragedy? What you're saying is nothing but the logic of the strong, of the victor. You don't know the pain of the downtrodden. You are insulting them.
No. You're wrong. It is precisely because I believe in human potential that I am opposed to getting drunk on tragedy.
Look, it hasn't been my intention to find out what kind of life you have led, but I think I've started to understand. Basically, without ever having had a major setback or encountering overwhelming irrationality, you have crossed the threshold into a world of nebulous philosophy. That's why you can just brush aside people's emotional scars as if they're nothing. How exceptionally blessed you've been.
It seems you are having difficulty accepting this. Well, let's give something else a try. This is a triangular column that we use occasionally in counseling.
Sounds interesting. Please explain.
This triangular column represents our psyche. From where you are sitting right now, you should be able to see only two of the three sides. What is written on those sides?
One side says, "That bad person." The other says, poor me.
Right. Most of the people who come for counselling start off talking about one or the other. They tearfully complain about the unhappiness that has befallen them, or they speak of their hatred for the people who torment them and the society that surrounds them. It is not only in counselling that I've encountered this behaviour. When speaking with family and friends, or when offering consultation, it is not an easy thing to be conscious of what one is talking about at that moment. However, by visualizing it in this way, one can see clearly that what one is talking about is actually just these two things. It sounds familiar, doesn't it?
To blame that bad person, or to plead poor me. Well, I guess you could put it that way.
But this is not the point we should be talking to each other about. No matter how much you seek agreement regarding that bad person, or complain about poor me, regardless of whether there is someone who listens and understands, even if you derive some temporary comfort from it, this will not lead to a true solution.
Then what can one do?
The triangular column has another side that is hidden from you now. What do you think is written on it?
Hey, stop messing around and just show it to me.
All right. Please read out loud what it says there.
The philosopher had brought out a piece of paper folded into a triangular column. From where the youth sat, only two of its three faces could be seen. On one face were the words, "That bad person," and on the other, "Poor me." According to the philosopher, the complaints of anxious people always ended up being one or the other. And then the philosopher slowly rotated the triangular column with his thin fingers and revealed the words written on the remaining face, words that shook the youth's heart. There's no magic in Adlerian psychology.
Well, say it out loud.
What should I do from now on?
Yes, this is precisely the point we should be talking to each other about. What should I do from now on? We do not need that bad person. Neither is poor me necessary. No matter how loudly you complain about them, I will just ignore it.
You are inhuman.
I will not ignore it out of indifference. I will ignore it because there is nothing there that we should talk to each other about. If I were to listen to stories about that bad person or poor me and sympathize with your plight by saying things like, "That must have been tough," or "It's not your fault at all," it is true that you might get some temporary solace. And you might even have a sense of satisfaction that it was good to get counseling or good to consult this person. But how would that change things the next day and every day after that? Wouldn't you just want to seek more solace the next time you are hurt? Isn't that dependence? That is why in Adlerian psychology we talk to each other about what should one do from now on.
But if you're saying I should think seriously about my own from now on, then first I would need to know about until now as its precondition.
No. Right now, you are in front of me. It is enough to know you who are in front of me, and in principle there is no way for me to know the past you. I repeat, the past does not exist. The past you speak of is nothing more than a story skillfully compiled by you now. Please, understand this point.
No way! You're just sticking random pieces of theory together and reproaching me to stop whining. You're just pushing the logic of the arrogant and strong without any regard for human weakness, without even trying to become familiar with that weakness.
That is not so. For example, it is not uncommon for us counselors to simply pass this triangular column to the client, and we make the following request. It does not matter what the subject is, so please turn it to show me the content of what you are going to talk about. At that, many people choose, "What should I do from now on?" of their own accord, and then begin thinking about the substance of that.
Of their own accord?
In other schools of counselling, there are shock therapy-style approaches that attempt to provoke explosions of emotion by tracing deep into the past. But there is absolutely no need to engage in such practices. We are not prestidigitators or magicians. I repeat, there is no magic in Adlerian psychology, a constructive and scientific psychology of human knowledge that is based not on mysterious magic, but on respect for people. That is Adlerian psychology.
Wow, you're going out on a limb again and using the word scientific?
I am.
All right, I'll swallow that. For the time being, I will allow that. Now, let's get down to talking together about what is really the biggest issue for me. My from now on. My future as an educator.
Part 2. Why negate reward and punishment? This dialogue with the philosopher wasn't going to be wrapped up so easily, the youth realized. He had to admit it. This old Socrates was a formidable opponent, especially with all the abstract theories he kept bringing up. But the youth still felt sure he would win in the end.
Take the discussion out of this little study as soon as possible and bring it to the classroom. Put it to the test in the real world. I don't want to just criticize it haphazardly, but it's just a bunch of pie-in-the-sky theories that are totally divorced from reality. And I want to bring it all down to earth, into people's actual lives.
The youth pulled up a chair and took a deep breath. The classroom is a democratic nation.
In this world, the past does not exist. One must not get drunk on the cheap wine of tragedy. The only thing we should be talking to each other about is what should be done from now on. Okay, I'll go along with this premise. The issue I'll be facing from now on, I suppose, is the kind of teaching I put into practice in my school. So I'm going to get into this area of discussion right away. You're okay with that, right?
Of course.
All right. Earlier, you said that the concrete first step is to start from respect, right? This is what I want to ask you. Do you think that just by bringing respect into the classroom, that will solve everything? In other words, that the students will stop making any trouble?
That won't solve things on its own. There will still be trouble.
Then I'll have to yell at them after all, won't I? Because they're still engaging in bad conduct and being a nuisance to other students.
No, you must not rebuke them.
So you're saying I should just let them do bad things right under my nose and not do anything about it? But that's no different from saying that a thief shouldn't be caught and punished, now is it? Would Adler accept such lawlessness?
Adler's view is not that one ignores laws or rules. That is, as long as they are rules that have been created through a democratic process. This is an extremely important point, both for society as a whole and for running a classroom.
A democratic process?
Yes. Think of your classroom as a democratic nation.
Huh. What do you mean?
The principle of national sovereignty is that sovereign power rests with the people. The people then establish all manner of rules on the basis of mutual consent, and those rules are applied equally to all citizens. And so, rather than simply obeying the rules, they can observe them more actively as our rules. On the other hand, what happens when rules are established according to someone's solitary judgment, rather than on the basis of citizen consensus, and when, furthermore, those rules are enforced very unequally?
Well, you can bet the people won't be quiet about it.
Then, to suppress a rebellion, the ruler would have no choice but to exercise tangible and intangible powers. This is something that concerns not only the nation, but the corporation and the family too. An organization in which someone is using their power to suppress has irrationality at its foundation.
I see.
The same goes for the classroom. The sovereign of the classroom nation is not the teacher, it's the students. And the rules of the classroom must be established on the basis of consensus from the students who are sovereign. Let us start with this principle in mind.
As usual, you're making things very complicated. So, what you're saying is that the students should be allowed to govern themselves? Our school already has a regular system of self-government in place, with a student council and such.
No, I am talking about something more fundamental. If, for example, we think of the classroom as a nation, then the students are the citizens. What would be the position of the teacher, then?
Well, if you're saying the students are the citizens, I suppose the teacher would be the prime minister or president who acts as their leader.
But that doesn't seem right, does it? Were you chosen by the students in an election? And if you were to call yourself a president without having gone through an election, it wouldn't be a democratic nation. It would just be a dictatorship.
I guess so. Logically speaking, anyway.
I am not talking about logic, but about reality. The classroom is not a dictatorship that is ruled over by the teacher. It is a democratic nation in which each and every student is sovereign. Teachers who forget this principle set up a dictatorship without even realizing it.
So, you're saying I've got fascistic leanings?
If you put it in extreme terms, yes. The fact that your classroom has gotten out of control is not the problem of your students individually, and you are not insufficiently qualified as a teacher. It is only that the situation there is akin to a corrupted dictatorship. That is why it is out of control. An organization that is under the command of a dictator cannot escape corruption.
Stop making accusations. On what grounds can you make such criticisms?
The grounds are quite clear. It is that reward and punishment which you insist is necessary.
What are you talking about?
This is what you came to talk to me about, yes? The subject of praising and rebuking.
It's funny that you're the one who's throwing down the gauntlet. I've gained a fair amount of teaching experience, especially in real classrooms. I'm going to make you take back those extremely rude accusations. You can count on it.
All right, let's talk it over to our heart's content.
Do not rebuke and do not praise.
Adler forbids reward and punishment. He advises not to rebuke and not to praise. Why did Adler espouse such nonsense? And did he realize how much of a gap there is between the ideal and the reality? That is what I want to know.
I see. Just to make sure, you think of rebuking and praising as both being necessary.
Yes, of course I do. Even if my students might not like me because of it, I still have to rebuke them. They have to correct their mistakes. Yes. Let's start with whether rebuking is right or wrong.
All right. Why must one not rebuke a person? It is probably best to look at this according to the situation. First, consider a boy who has done something bad. It could be something dangerous or that might harm another person or something approaching a criminal act. Why on earth did the boy do such a thing? One thing that may be considered, then, is the possibility that he did not know it was a bad thing.
He didn't know?
Right, I'll use my own story as an example. When I was a child, I had a magnifying glass with me, wherever I went. I'd find insects and plants and look at them through it. I passed the time gazing to my heart's content at worlds that were invisible to the naked eye. I'd spend all day absorbed in observing them, like a little entomologist.
Yes, I had such a phase too.
A little while later, though, I learned of a completely different use for the magnifying glass. I'd focus the sunlight through it onto a piece of black paper, and lo and behold, smoke would rise from the paper until at last it would begin to burn. Witnessing this miracle of science that seemed like a magic trick, I felt the excitement course through me, and I couldn't think of it as a magnifying glass anymore.
It's really something, isn't it? I, too, found that more to my liking, more so than crawling around the ground staring at bugs. A small magnifying glass may inspire one to contemplate the power of the sun and even contemplate the universe. It's a boy's first step into science.
So, I was playing in this way one hot summer day by burning paper. I'd placed a sheet of black paper on the ground, and I was focusing the light with my magnifying glass, as I always did, when out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of a solitary ant. It was a large and sturdy ant with a deep black exoskeleton. I was getting bored already with the black paper, so what did I do to the black ant with my magnifying glass? I don't think I need to explain any further.
I get it. Well, children can be cruel.
Yes, children often do exhibit this sort of brutality of killing insects for fun. But are children really cruel? Do they walk around with some latent aggressive behavior, as Freud calls it? I don't think so. Children are not cruel, it's just that they don't know. They do not know what life is worth or about other people's pain. So there is one thing that adults should do. If children do not know, teach them. And when teaching them, there is no need for words of reprimand. Please do not forget this principle, because it is not that they were engaging in bad behavior, but simply that they did not know.
You're saying that it's not aggression or brutality, but a crime arising from ignorance?
A child playing on railroad tracks might not realize that it is a dangerous thing to do. A child shouting loudly in a public place might not know he is causing a disturbance. Whatever it may be, we all start from a point of not knowing. Wouldn't you say that it is unreasonable to sternly reproach someone if they do not know that what they are doing is wrong?
Sure, if they really don't know.
What is needed of us adults is not to reprimand, but to teach. With words of reason and without getting emotional or raising our voices. You are not someone who cannot do this.
If that were the only example, then it'd be just as you say. Because there's no way you're going to accept your own ant-killing brutality, right? But this isn't a line of reasoning that I'll ever swallow. It just feels like it'll get stuck in the back of my throat, like thick maple syrup or something. Your understanding of people is too naive.
What is naive about it?
Kindergarteners are one thing. But when it comes to grammar school children, and even more so with middle schoolers, they're all fully aware of what they're doing. They've known for a long time what's prohibited and what's considered immoral. You might say that these kids engage in problem behavior as prisoners of conscience. They've got to be severely punished for their offenses. So I wish you would just dispense with this old man act of making them out to be a bunch of pure-hearted angels.
To be sure, there are many children who engage in problem behavior knowing full well that it is wrong, and that may even be the case for the majority of them. But haven't you ever found it odd? They're engaging in problem behavior not only with the knowledge that it is wrong, but with the understanding that they will be rebuked by their parents and teachers for acting out. It's quite irrational.
It's simplistic. That's what it is. They would understand if they'd only calm down and think it over, but they're incapable of that.
But is that really the case? Can't you see that there is another mentality operating deep inside them?
So they do it knowing that they're going to be rebuked? Even the kids who cry when they're rebuked?
It would not be a waste of effort to consider that possibility, certainly. In contemporary Adlerian psychology, we think of human problem behavior as having five stages, each of which has its own mental state operating in the background.
Oh, you're finally getting to the psychology.
Once you comprehend the five stages of problem behavior, you should be able to see for yourself whether rebuking is right or wrong.
Let's hear it then. And I'm going to see how much you really comprehend children. And the actual educational setting. This philosopher's reasoning makes no sense at all.
The youth had become incensed.
The classroom is a small democratic nation, and the sovereigns of the classroom are the students. Fine, up to that point, but why are reward and punishment unnecessary? If the classroom is a nation, aren't laws needed there? And if there are people who break laws and commit crimes, aren't punishments needed?
The youth wrote the words, "the five stages of problem behavior," in his notebook and smiled to himself.
I am going to ascertain if Adlerian psychology is an area of study that actually holds water in the real world, or if it's just a bunch of empty theories.
What is the goal of problem behavior?
Why do children get involved in problem behavior? Adlerian psychology focuses on the goals that lie hidden in that behavior. That is to say, we think of the problem behavior that children and adults engage in with all manner of goals as having five stages.
Does having five stages mean it is something that gradually escalates?
Yes, and these stages cover all forms of human problem behavior. When possible, steps must be taken at an early stage before the behavior escalates.
All right. So what is the first stage?
The first stage of problem behavior is demand for admiration.
Demand for admiration? In other words, it's as if they're saying, "Praise me?"
Yes. At this stage, students play the role of the good child to their parents and teachers and to others. A person working in an organization strives to demonstrate their drive and obedience to their boss and senior colleagues. By doing so, they hope to gain their praise. This is where it all starts.
But isn't that desirable behavior? They're being productive and not causing trouble for anyone. They can make themselves useful to other people. I can't find any reason to regard this as problematic.
Certainly, if each of their actions is treated as separate, they may appear to be good children or honor students who have no problems whatsoever. And with children who make great efforts in their schoolwork and athletics and such, or with company employees who devote themselves to their work, they are applying themselves, so one wants to praise them. There is a great pitfall here, however. Their goal will always be to receive praise, and moreover, to gain a privileged position within the community.
Aha! So since their motives aren't pure, they're unacceptable? What a simple-minded philosopher you are. Even if their goal is to receive praise, they're still students pursuing their studies, aren't they? I don't see any problem here.
Then what do you think happens when their efforts garner no praise at all from their parents and teachers or their bosses and co-workers?
I suppose they become dissatisfied and maybe even resentful.
Right. Think of it this way. They are not doing good things. They are seeking praise. And there is no point in making so much effort if they are not going to be praised or treated in a special way. So they lose motivation right away. They adopt a lifestyle or worldview in which they are essentially saying, "I won't engage in proper behavior unless there is someone who will praise me, and I'll engage in improper behavior unless there is someone who will punish me."
Well, I guess that's true, but...
Furthermore, another characteristic of this stage is that, on account of trying to be the good child who is full of promise, they begin to engage in cheating, deceptive tactics, and other wrongdoing. Educators and leaders must ascertain the children's goals instead of focusing only on their actions.
But if you don't praise them at any point, they'll lose their drive and turn into children who don't do anything at all. And in some cases, they'll start engaging in improper behavior, won't they?
No. You teach them continually that they have worth, even if they are not special, by showing them respect.
Concretely speaking, how do you do that?
Instead of focusing on whenever a child does some good thing, turn your attention to the smaller, everyday details of their words and actions. And then focus on and sympathize with that person's concerns. That's all.
Ah, so we're back to that. Well, I guess I still don't feel comfortable with what qualifies as problem behavior. But let's move on. What about the second stage?
The second stage of problem behavior is attention drawing.
Attention drawing?
The child isn't being praised even though they have done a good thing. They are unable to gain a privileged position within the classroom. Or they don't have enough courage or tenacity to follow through with being praised in the first place. At such times, the person thinks, it's okay not to be praised, so I'll just make myself stand out.
So, they will do something bad? Something they will get rebuked for?
That's right. At this stage, they don't even think about being praised anymore. They just want to stand out. One aspect I would like you to bear in mind here is that the principle of the behavior of children at this stage is standing out, not being bad.
What will they accomplish by standing out?
They want to gain a privileged position within the classroom. They want a definite place to be within the community to which they belong. That is their true goal.
In other words, since orthodox methods such as doing their schoolwork haven't worked out, the student tries to become a special me by other means. Instead of becoming special as a good child, they try to do so as a bad child. In this way, they secure their own place to be.
That's exactly right.
Well, I'd say that around that age, if you're a bit of a bad child, you're more likely to be viewed as superior. So, concretely speaking, in what way do they make themselves stand out?
Assertive children will probably try to get attention by mischief. That is to say, by breaking the lesser rules of society and school. Being noisy in class, ridiculing the teacher, inundating the teacher with endless questions, that kind of thing. But they never go so far as to incur the wrath of the adults, and they are often loved by their teachers and friends alike as a kind of popular class clown. Passive children will probably try to get attention by exhibiting a dramatic drop in scholastic achievement, by repeatedly forgetting things, or by crying. They get attention by acting like an incompetent child and try to gain a special position.
But if they do things like disrupting class or repeatedly forgetting things, they'll probably be rebuked quite severely. Are they okay with being rebuked?
If their presence is likely to be otherwise ignored, they would much rather be rebuked. They want their presence recognized, and they want to be put in a special position, even if it takes the form of rebuke. That is their wish.
Oh, my, that's harsh. What a complicated frame of mind.
No, actually, children up to this second stage are living according to a simple principle, and dealing with them is not so difficult. Through respect, we can convey that there is no need to be special and that they have sufficient worth just as they are. It is from the third stage onward that things get difficult.
Why is that, I wonder?
Hate me. Abandon me.
In the third stage of problem behavior, their goals plunge into power struggles.
Power struggles?
Yielding to no one, repeated provocation and challenging others to battle. By winning that battle, each one tries to make a show of his own might. Each one tries to gain a privileged position. This is a quite tough stage.
What do you mean by challenging others to battle? They don't actually start hitting each other, do they?
In a word, it is resistance. They provoke their parents and teachers and swear at them. Sometimes they become enraged and violent or run around engaging in shoplifting and smoking cigarettes and the like, and they will break rules without a second thought.
Well, they're the real problem children. Yes, these are exactly the sorts of kids I feel helpless dealing with.
Passive children, on the other hand, will challenge one to a power struggle through disobedience. No matter how much they are rebuked with stern words, they will refuse to engage in their studies or lessons. They will pretend to ignore the words of the adults. They don't particularly want to study, but they don't feel that study is unnecessary either. It is simply that they want to prove their own might by being resolutely disobedient.
It's infuriating just imagining it. There's no way to handle such problem children other than by yelling at them. They really are breaking the rules, and it makes me want to just give them a good smack. Because if I don't, I'm essentially condoning their misdeeds.
Right. Many parents and teachers choose to reprimand their children and students in anger. But this is nothing more than giving in to the provocation of the other and standing on the same court with them. They will be only too glad to respond with resistance, because their battle has just begun.
So, what can be done about it?
If there is a legal issue, then it must be dealt with in a legal manner. With any other power struggle, however, get off the battlefield as soon as you detect it. That's the only thing you should do right away. Consider that even without making reprimands, just by looking like you're about to get angry, you will end up standing on the battlefield of the power struggle.
But what if there's a student doing something bad right in front of me? What do I do about this in real life? Is an educator someone who just leaves the student alone and doesn't do anything?
I'm sure there is a single logical conclusion, but it would be better to wait until I have explained all 5 stages before we think it over together.
Ugh, how annoying. Next!
The 4th stage of problem behavior is the one where the person plunges into the stage of revenge.
Revenge?
They have made up their mind to enter a power struggle, but it was beyond their ability. They are unable to win a victory or gain a privileged position. They are snubbed by others and suffer a defeat. Having lost the battle in this way, the person withdraws temporarily and then plots revenge.
Who do they take revenge on, and for what purpose?
They take love's revenge on those who would not recognize the irreplaceable me, on those who would not love them.
Love's revenge?
Please remember, demand for admiration, attention drawing, and power struggles are all expressions of the love-starved feeling that says, I want you to have greater regard for me. The thing is, the moment that a person realizes that their longing for love will not be fulfilled, they do an about-face and begin to look for hate.
Why? What is the point of looking for hate?
I realize now that they aren't going to love me. If that's how it's going to be, then hate me. Pay attention to me within that emotion of hatred. This is the kind of thing they think.
They wish to be hated?
That is what happens. Take, for example, the children of the 3rd stage who oppose their parents and teachers and challenge them to power struggles. In the classroom, they have a chance of becoming minor heroes, of being celebrated for their courage to stand up to authority and to adults. But children who plunge into the stage of revenge are not celebrated by anyone. Hated and feared by their parents and teachers and even their classmates, little by little, they become isolated. Even so, they try to connect with others through that one point of being hated.
If that's how it is, we should just pretend to ignore them. Just break that point of contact, which has become hateful, because there won't be any need for revenge that way. We can figure out some other more sensible approach, can't we?
That might work in theory, but in reality, it is quite difficult to tolerate their conduct.
Why is that? Are you saying that I don't have the patience for it?
With children in the power struggles stage, for example, they will challenge one to battle, head-on, fair and square. Their provocations, which bristle with abusive language, are directly related to their sense of justice. That is why they may be seen as heroes by their classmates. It is possible to deal with this kind of provocation in a calm way. With children in the stage of revenge, on the other hand, one does not choose to fight them directly. They are not planning to do bad things. They are just repeating things that other people don't like.
Could you give me a concrete example?
An obvious one would be what is known as stalking behavior, which is a typical form of revenge. It is love's revenge aimed at the person who would not love you. People who become stalkers are well aware that their target will not like their behavior, and they are aware that good relations cannot come out of it. But they will still plot to connect in some way through hatred or dislike.
What kind of unpleasant logic is that?
Self-harm and social withdrawal are also considered to be within the realm of revenge in Adlerian psychology. By engaging in harm to oneself and injury to one's worth, one accuses the other, saying, "It's your fault I've ended up this way." Naturally, the child's parents will worry, and it will be a heart-wrenching experience for them. From the child's point of view, the revenge is succeeding.
Well, we're venturing into the domain of the psychiatrist now, aren't we? Any other examples?
While we often hear about cases that escalate to violence or abusive language, there are also many problem children who get involved with groups of delinquents or with organized crime. And with passive children, there are all kinds of methods of revenge, such as letting themselves get abnormally dirty or indulging in grotesque habits that are sure to arouse feelings of dislike in those around them.
What should we do when confronted with such children?
If there are students like this in your classroom, there is nothing you can do about it. Their goal is revenge on you. The more you try to give them a helping hand, the more their words and actions will escalate, as they will only see it as an opportunity for revenge. At this point, the only thing to do is request assistance from a completely outside party who has no interest in the situation whatsoever. In other words, you would have no choice but to turn to another teacher or to people outside the school, including specialists like me, for example.
But if this is the fourth stage, there's something beyond it, right?
Yes, there is the final stage, which is even more troublesome than revenge.
Please, tell me.
The fifth stage of problem behavior is proof of incompetence.
Proof of incompetence?
That's right. Here, please try to think about it as if it were you yourself. Though you have taken all sorts of steps to ensure that you will be treated as a special being, none of them is going as planned. Your parents and teachers, and even your classmates, are not hating you as you wish them to. You cannot find a place to be in either the classroom or at home. What would you do if this were you?
I'd probably give up right away. Because no matter what I do, I can't get anyone to acknowledge me. I guess I just stop making any effort at all.
Still, your parents and teachers would lecture you that you need to study more, and they would start intervening in various things, such as your attitude in school and your relationship with friends, because they want to help you, of course.
It's none of their business. If they could do it right, they could have done it a long time ago. I wish they wouldn't care at all.
You won't be able to get them to understand that. The people around you want you to try harder. They know you can do things, and they are expecting you to change through your own work on yourself.
What I'm saying is that sort of expectation is a big nuisance. I'd want them to leave me alone.
That's right. It's that feeling of "don't expect anything more of me" that connects to proof of incompetence.
So what you're saying is, don't expect anything of me. Because I'm incompetent?
Yes. They start to despair of life, they despise themselves from the bottom of their heart, and they firmly believe that they can't solve anything. So in order to avoid experiencing any more despair, they try to run away from all their schoolwork. They are announcing to those around them, "This is how incompetent I am, so don't give me any assignments. I don't have the ability to complete them."
They do this in order to not get hurt anymore?
That's right. If they think, "Maybe I can do it," when they undertake an assignment and then end up failing to complete it, they will wish they had decided there's no way I can do it at the outset and just given up. Because it would be easier that way, and there would be no worry of being further overcome with disappointment.
Well, I can understand the feeling.
Then, by various means, they try to prove how incompetent they are. They act as if they are utter fools, become lethargic about everything, and stop trying to undertake even the easiest assignments. Eventually, they convince even themselves of being me the fool.
It's true that there are students who say they're stupid.
If they can put it into words, they are probably just making fun of themselves. With children who are really in the fifth stage, while they are acting like utter fools, they may appear to actually be suffering some mental illness. Whenever they find themselves trying to do their work or trying to think about things, they immediately stop themselves. And then they pessimistically reject their assignments and the expectations of those around them.
How should we interact with such children?
What they are wishing is, don't expect anything of me, don't care about me, and even abandon me. The more their parents and teachers try to help them, the more they will demonstrate proof of incompetence in extreme ways. Unfortunately, there is nothing you can do. You will just have to turn to a specialist. Because, even for a specialist, the path of providing assistance to children who have entered the proof of incompetence stage is a very difficult one.
There's not much we educators can do for them.
Actually, the majority of problem behaviors can be stopped during the power struggles of the third stage. So the role given to educators is a major one in preventing those behaviors from progressing further.
If there is punishment, does the crime go away?
The five stages of problem behavior. It certainly is an interesting analysis. First, you look for admiration. Then, you go all out to get people's attention. When that doesn't work, you start power struggles, which then turn into heinous revenge. And lastly, you make a show of your own incompetence.
And all of these are rooted in a sense of belonging. That is to say, the goal of securing a special position within the community.
Right. That is a very Adlerian psychology, style, interpersonal relationship-focused line of reasoning. Let's acknowledge this classification. But have you forgotten? Shouldn't we be discussing whether rebuking is right or wrong? Look, I have put this Adlerian no-rebuking education into practice. I have waited, without rebuking no matter what, for them to notice things on their own. And what do you think has happened to my class as a result? It's turned into a complete zoo, without any rules whatsoever.
So, you chose rebuking. Did anything change by rebuking?
If I yell at the students in a loud voice when they're being noisy, things quiet down right away. And if I rebuke them when they forget to do their homework, they get looks of self-reflection on their faces. It doesn't last, though. They start making noise again in short order, and they stop doing their homework, too.
Why do you think it happens this way?
I'm telling you, it's because of Adler. It was a mistake to decide to start with no rebuking. Since I started off by being easygoing and allowing everything, they look down on me now and think, this guy's nothing to be afraid of, and he'll let us get away with anything.
Would it have been different if you'd been rebuking from the start?
Of course it would have. This is my greatest regret. In everything, the way you start is crucial. Next year, if I get assigned to a different classroom, I'm going to start yelling at them strictly from the very first day.
So, there are some very strict people among your co-workers and senior colleagues, aren't there?
Yes. Well, no one goes as far as corporal punishment, of course, but there are several teachers who always yell at their students and instruct them using strict language. They put everything they have into playing the bad guy, into the role of the teacher. I guess you could say they are paragons of the professional educator.
Well, that's strange. Why are these teachers always yelling?
Why? Because the students do bad things.
No, because if rebuking were effective as an educational approach, just doing it a few times at the outset should be enough to put a stop to the problem behavior. Why do they end up always rebuking? Why do they always put on a scary face and always use a loud voice? Hasn't it ever seemed odd to you?
But it's because those kids are so impossible.
No, you are wrong. This is undeniable proof that rebuking is not effective in any way as an educational approach. Even if you were to engage in strict rebuking from the start next year, the situation would not be any different from now. It might actually be worse.
It'd be worse?
You should understand by now that their problem behavior is such in which being rebuked by you is implied. It is their wish to be reprimanded.
They wish to be rebuked by their teacher? They enjoy it? Well, now they're masochists. Stop joking around.
I wouldn't say that anyone enjoys being rebuked, but there is a sense of heroic fulfillment in being able to say to oneself, I did something that was special enough to get rebuked. They can prove to themselves that they are special beings by getting rebuked.
No, before being a question of human psychology, this is a question of law and order. There's someone doing something bad right in front of you. Regardless of what goal might be involved, that person is breaking a rule. It is only natural to punish them for that. If that is not done, the public order cannot be maintained.
You are rebuking in order to maintain law and order?
That's right. It's not that I want to rebuke my students, and I don't want to punish them either. It's obvious. Who would want to do that kind of thing? But punishment is necessary. One reason is to maintain law and order, and another is as a deterrence against crime.
What do you mean by deterrence?
A boxer in the ring, for example, even if he finds himself in a tight spot with no way out, will never kick at or try to throw his opponent no matter what, because he knows full well that he'll be disqualified if he does anything like that. So, the grave punishment, disqualification, functions as a deterrence against rule violation. If the administering of that punishment is inconsistent, it will no longer act as a deterrence, and the boxing match will no longer exist as such. Punishment is the only deterrence against crime.
It is an interesting example. Then why don't such serious punishments, in other words, the reprimands all of you are giving, function as a deterrence in an actual education setting?
There are all kinds of opinions about that. The senior teachers all reminisce about the old days when corporal punishment was allowed. Basically, they say that times have changed, and because punishment has gotten lighter, it has lost its function as a deterrence.
I see. Now, let's probe a little deeper into why rebuking cannot have any effectiveness as an educational approach.
The five stages of problem behavior conveyed by the philosopher, to be sure, the truths they contained were accurate assessments of human psychology and offered glimpses of the greatness of Adler. The youth thought,
still, I am the only adult in charge of my classroom, and it is up to me to set an example as a person living in society. In other words, if punishment is not meted out to those who engage in wrongdoing, the order of this society will fall apart. I am not a philosopher who uses theories to treat people like playthings. I'm an educator who bears responsibility for our children's future. This weight, this responsibility for people living in the real world, is not something this man is capable of understanding.
Violence in the name of communication.
So, where do we begin?
All right. Let's suppose that a violent fight breaks out between two students in your classroom. A quarrel over something trivial has developed into a full-scale fist fight. What would you do with them?
In that sort of situation, I would not rebuke them loudly or anything like that. Rather, I'd calmly listen to what both sides had to say. I'd get them to cool down first and then ask them things like, why did you start fighting? And why were you hitting each other?
How do you think they would answer?
Well, I guess it'd be something like, he said such and such and I just blew up, or he did this horrible thing to me.
Then what would you do?
I'd let them both have their say, ascertain which student was in the wrong, and then get that one to apologize. However, since in all disputes it's really both sides that are in the wrong, I'd actually be getting them to apologize to each other.
Would they be satisfied with that?
Naturally, they'd both prefer to stick to their versions of what happened, but if both of them are able to think, maybe it's partly my fault, I would let it go at that. There's that saying, in a quarrel, both parties are to blame.
I see. Now, suppose you had that triangular column with you.
The triangular column?
Yes. On one face are written the words, that bad person. On another, poor me, And on the last one, what should I do from now on? Listen to your students while visualizing the triangular column in much the same way that we counselors do.
How do you mean?
The students' reasons for fighting. He said such and such, and he did this horrible thing to me. When you think about them with the triangular column, isn't it just the same as that bad person and poor me?
Yes, I guess so.
You're asking the students only about the cause. No matter how much you might delve into that, all you're going to get is excuses and abdications of responsibility. What you should be doing is focusing on their goals and thinking with them, what should I do from now on?
The goal of the fight, not the cause?
Let's figure this out step by step. First of all, we humans usually communicate through language, right?
Yes, like we are talking to each other right now.
Then, what would you say is the goal or objective of communication?
I'd say it's transmission of intention, the conveying of what is on one's mind.
No. Conveying is nothing more than the gateway of communication. The final objective is the establishment of consensus. Conveying does not have meaning on its own. It is only when the content of what is conveyed has been understood and a certain consensus has been reached that communication has meaning. So, we are talking together in this way with the aim of getting to some point of consensus.
Okay, but it's sure taking a long time.
Right. Language-based communication necessitates a great deal of time and effort to arrive at consensus. One doesn't just get one's own egotistical demands accepted. Rather, one has to collect persuasive material, such as objective data. Moreover, in terms of certainty and immediate effectiveness, it is rather poor for the costs incurred.
It's exactly as you say. It gets tiresome.
What does the person who is finding a discussion tiresome or feeling that they have no chance of winning the discussion do at that point? Do you know?
Well, I suppose they wouldn't just bow out, would they?
The means of communication they will choose in the end is violence.
Oh, well, that's great. That's where you make the connection?
By resorting to violence, one can push through one's demands without expending time or effort. To put it more directly, one can make the other party submit to one. In every way, violence is a low-cost, easy means of communication. But before deeming it morally unacceptable, we must say that it is a rather immature form of conduct for people to engage in.
You mean that it should not be rejected from a moral viewpoint, but rather because it is immature, foolish conduct?
Yes. Moral standards change with each time period or situation. Judging others solely on moral guidelines is extremely dangerous. After all, there have been times when violence is promoted. Now, what should one do? We humans have to get back to the basics. We must grow out of our immature condition. We must not rely on violence to communicate. Rather, we have to search for other kinds of communication. It does not matter what the cause may be, whether it is the thing the other person said, or their provocative attitude, or what have you. Violence has only one goal. What we should be thinking about is, what should I do from now on?
I see. That's an interesting insight with regard to violence.
Can you really act as if this were just someone else's business? What I am talking about can be applied to you, too.
No way. I don't engage in violence. Stop making strange accusations.
Getting angry and rebuking are synonymous.
You're in a discussion with someone when things take a bad turn. You're in a disadvantageous position. Or you were aware from the start of the discussion that your arguments lack rationality. Take, for example, the man who tries to push his arguments at such times, not with actual violence, perhaps, but through attempting to coerce the other party by raising his voice, slapping his hand on the table, or shedding tears. These kinds of conduct, too, must be regarded as low-cost, violent communication. You understand what I am saying, yes?
You damn insect! Just because I'm getting excited and raising my voice, you ridicule me by calling me an immature person?
No, I really don't mind at all how much you raise your voice here. The issue I am bringing up is the essence of the rebuking conduct that you are choosing. You feel annoyed by communicating with your students with words, and you are rebuking them to try to force them into quick submission. Using anger as a weapon, wielding guns of reproach, brandishing the sword of authority. This is an immature and foolish attitude for an educator to have.
No, I'm not angry at them. I'm rebuking them.
Many adults justify it this way, but it does not change the fact that they are trying to keep another person down by using violent force. Indeed, one might even say it is a vicious excuse, as it contains the awareness of those adults who tell themselves, "I am doing a good thing."
That's not how it is. Look, anger is an explosion of emotion when one cannot make calm judgments. This is what I mean when I rebuke them. I don't get emotional at all. Instead of getting bent out of shape, I rebuke them in a calm and calculated manner. Don't group me with people who forget themselves and fly into a rage.
Or maybe that is how it is. You might compare yourself to a gun loaded with blanks, but there is no difference from the standpoint of the students. They have a gun pointing at them. Whether it is loaded with real bullets or not, you are communicating with a gun in your hand.
Okay, let's try this. Suppose the other person is some kind of brutal criminal who's holed up with a knife. He has committed a crime and is challenging you to battle. One of those battles for drawing attention or struggles for power or what have you. What's wrong with communicating with a gun in your hand? How else do we maintain law and order?
What should parents and educators do when confronted with problem behavior in children? Adler advises that we renounce the standpoint of the judge. You have not been granted the privilege of passing down judgments. Maintaining law and order is not your job.
Then what are you telling me to do instead?
Rather than being concerned with law and order, what you should be doing is protecting the child right in front of you, the child who has engaged in problem behavior. Educators are counselors, and counseling is re-education. We spoke about this earlier, didn't we? It would be peculiar for a counselor to take out a gun or anything like that.
But still.
Violence, which includes reprimand, is a form of communication that reveals one's immaturity as a human being. This is something that the children know well enough themselves. Whenever they receive reprimands, in addition to their fear of violent conduct, at an unconscious level, they have the insight that this is an immature person. This is a much bigger problem than adults think. Could you respect an immature human being? And could you have a real feeling of being respected by someone who threatens you in a violent manner? There is no respect in communication with anger and violence. Rather, such communication invites contempt. That reprimand does not lead to substantive improvement is a self-evident truth. On this point, Adler states, anger is an emotion that pulls people apart.
I am not respected by my students, and moreover, they feel contempt for me because of my rebuking them?
Unfortunately, that is probably the case.
What do you know anyway? You don't understand what it's like in a real setting.
There are probably many things I do not understand. However, this real setting that you keep bringing up is basically another version of that bad person and the poor me who is at their mercy. I do not imagine there to be any more value in those words beyond what is necessary. It will all just go in one ear and out the other.
Ah!
If you have gained the courage to face yourself and to consider the true meaning of what should I do from now on, you will make progress.
So, you are saying that I'm just making excuses?
No. Excuse is probably not the correct word. You are simply focusing only on the things one cannot change and lamenting, so it's impossible. Instead of clinging to the things one cannot change, look at the things one can change that are right in front of you. Do you remember the Serenity Prayer that has been passed down orally in Christian societies?
Yes, of course I do. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Reflect upon these words, and then think once more about what should I do from now on.